Hello, everyone, and welcome to Therapy in a Nutshell. I'm Emma McAdam, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is the podcast where I condense mental health skills into bite-sized nuggets of help. If you're ready to learn more in-depth mental health skills, check out my online courses on anxiety, coping skills, and how to change your brain, 10 alternatives to medication to improve mental health. The link is in the description. You can use the code NUTSHELL for 25% off. Okay, back to the show.
All right, everyone, I am super excited today because I have a special guest on my channel. His name's Nick Wignall, and he has a blog that I read all the time, and every time I read it, I learn something new. So I think you guys are really gonna love him because the way he teaches and the way he explains concepts is very orderly, and it gives you really actionable steps. So today we are meeting with Nick Wignall. So hi, Nick, thank you so much for joining my channel, for being willing to spend some time with us today.
Yeah, you bet, thanks for having me, Anna.
Yeah, really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. Today we are going to talk a little bit about how we talk to ourselves and how we treat ourselves and some ways we can improve that to do a little bit better. So, first up, I just want to say, so Nick Wignall, he is a clinical psychologist. He works, you know, down in the trenches of mental health every day, working with clients, helping people out. And from what I can tell on your blog, Nick, you tell me if this is correct or not. You use kind of a CBT and ACT approach in your counseling. Now, what
yeah,
else?
I think that,
sorry. I saw you nodding, and then I just kept going. What else? You know, what's your specialty? What's your theoretical approach?
Yeah, I mean, I was trained in a pretty straight CBT model, kind of second wavy, and then yeah, I got exposed to a lot of third wave stuff, which is more prominent these days. And I try to, I mean, I kind of pick and choose. I don't feel especially tied to any particular theory, but yeah. I guess I'm kind of a pragmatist at heart. So whatever seems to kind of work for people. And I specialize in anxiety and sleep issues. So those are kind of the two areas where I really, really focus a lot. And I think that could have something to do with the way I think theoretically is that something like ACT in particular, I think really, I know it's sort of presented as sort of a transdiagnostic approach, but in my experience, it really works well for conceptualizing and working with folks who struggle with anxiety in particular. So that's probably a big part of it too.
I would agree with that. I found ACT to be super helpful with anxiety because it kind of lets go of that struggle that sometimes with maybe an older approach, like the cognitive behavioral approach with anxiety, sometimes people get wrapped up in a struggle of trying to change their thoughts a little, and that can leave them trapped, whereas ACT, you know, you let go of that struggle a little bit. So I don't know, maybe that's one of the reasons I love your blog so much is it uses that approach. I've read some of your articles on sleep and I'm like, yes, like this is really cool. So I think you have a wonderful blog, so.
Oh, thank you.
Anyways, I'm going to put the link like right here in the video if you guys want to check out Nick's blog. He's got tons of content on all sorts of topics, and I really find it like helpful for me personally and in my practice. So,
thanks.
Anyways, yeah, I love your blog. So, okay, well, let's talk about self-talk, right?
Let's do it.
What is self-talk? How would you describe like what is self-talk?
Yeah, so in some ways, I think you don't want to get too complicated with it. It's just the way you talk to yourself in your head. Like we all talk to ourselves. I think some of us are more or less aware of how much we talk to ourselves and sort of the quality of that speech. But I think all of us kind of understand that like thoughts kind of run through your mind. The kind of two ways I like to think about it, there's two different ways I like to approach this. One is to think about it like you, just like you have different ways of talking to different people in your life, you know? So like I talk to my old rugby buddies from college in a very different way than I talk to my grandmother, right? Like it's just a different kind of style. I have like a different approach to talking. We tend to talk about different things. So the way I talk to certain people is gonna be a little bit different than the way I talk to other people. And so one way you can think about self-talk is, just like you have a certain style or approach to talking with different people in your life, most of us have a certain style of talking to ourselves. And so that's one way of looking at self-talk. The other kind of metaphor I like for it is, it's like your self-talk is like the narrator in a book or a story, right? So I think a lot of times in life, we're kind of in go mode. We're just doing stuff, right? And that's like person perspective. You're sort of like the character in your story, right? You're doing things. You're talking to people. You're taking action, right? But then also we can think about ourselves and sort of talk to ourselves. You know, so we just got out of a tough meeting and we're like, oh gosh, like, I don't know if I should have said that, or like the what happened there, you know, so we kind of take this step back, or we're in the middle of the meeting and we're thinking to ourselves, oh my God, this is not going well. Everyone's falling asleep. Like I should have put more work, you know, whatever. So it's that we can be both the character and the narrator in our lives. And there's even sort of a third level, which is really pertinent to self-talk, which is there's the character level, first person, there's the narrator level, third person, right? But then there's like the author level. Someone created both the characters and the narrator, right? Mm-hmm. And not only can you step above the character level and kind of narrate things to yourself, you can step above the narrator level and you can ask yourself, like, how is my inner narrator talking about things? How am I talking to myself about what's happening to me? How am I talking to myself about myself, right? So you can step back and look at your own kind of inner narrator is like another way of thinking about self-talk. It's your inner narrator. I don't know if that's helpful, but.
That's a really interesting comparison because so basically if we're stuck in this character place, we just are doing what we are doing and we might not even be noticing how we're thinking about ourselves or how we're labeling ourselves. So for example, I have this client who I'm like, hey, you're kind of mean to yourself. And he's like, what are you talking about? No, I'm not. And I'm like, well, did you notice how you just called yourself an idiot? And he's like, no, well, that's not me. And he's unaware. So he's kind of stuck in this character mode. He's stuck in this place. And then if we step to the narrator mode, be like, oh, I noticed, is this what you're talking about? Right? Like, mm-hmm. I noticed that I called myself an idiot. I noticed that maybe, I'm talking about myself this way or thinking about this interaction this way. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's, I think you're, when you notice the narrator, then you're stepping into the author perspective, okay. Right? So when you notice yourself, when you're talking about yourself, you're in the narrator mode. But I think where a lot of us struggle, I think, honestly, most people who are sort of find themselves in therapy with me or who watch videos like this, their struggle on the level of the narrator mode. It's not that they're just acting unthinkingly. If anything, they're thinking too much. Or in an unhelpful way about themselves. They're thinking social anxiety is a common part of this, right? When you start to feel awkward and anxious in a social interaction, primarily because all your attention is on monitoring yourself and how you're doing. And of course you can't be very present in the car because you're constantly thinking about how is this going? How are they thinking about me? Like, how am I coming across, right? So you're stuck in narrator mode. Mm-hmm. And so, just like being stuck in kind of impulsive action mode can be unhelpful, being stuck in kind of narrative analysis mode can be really unhelpful as well. And that's why that ability to step out even beyond that into like the author sort of mode. And you can see the narrator just like, in some ways, it's just like another character in the story, right? And it's just as subject to inquiry or exploration or even assessment, saying like, I don't know if this is a really helpful way of, or accurate way of narrating what's going on right now.
Yeah, and like as an author, when you're in author mode, you say, well, maybe I'll write this a little differently, right?
Yes, exactly.
So ideally, we at least step into author mode occasionally, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes in our lives. But yeah, that makes so much sense, right? Like if you're in a social situation, you're feeling a little anxious, like, oh my gosh, what are they thinking about me? And then you're like, oh wait, no, now I'm getting anxious. I shouldn't get anxious. Or like, what's mm-hmm. the matter with me? Why am I talking to myself that way? I shouldn't be da-da-da. Then you get kind of wrapped up in like, in that little internal, like, I don't know, spiral in your head. Yeah.
And it prevents us from being present a lot of the time, right? I mean, ironically, sometimes we want to be more in first person mode. We want to be more just sort of in the present moment and like engaged with the people who are, who are across from us and really trying to be supportive or helpful or whatever it is. But if we're too stuck in narrator mode, there's kind of you know, economists talk about the idea of opportunity cost. Like if I spend a dollar on a hamburger, that's a dollar I can't spend on a coffee or an ice cream cone, right? And it's important to think about those trade-offs, right? So, yeah. But there's psychological opportunity cost too. If I'm spending all my time and energy in narrator mode, thinking about, you know, what I'm doing, how I'm coming across, that's time and energy I can't spend thinking about what the person across from me is actually saying, right? Mm-hmm. So there's real trade-offs associated with either of these two modes. And the author view lets you kind of look at both of those and say like, okay, given this situation, which mode do I actually want to be in?
Yeah. Yeah. So just kind of stepping back, looking, noticing how you're talking to yourself or noticing how you're labeling and describing yourself.
Yep.
And then choosing, well, is this a time for action? Right. Is this a time to get back in character mode and just like, just be at the party, just, mm-hmm. you know, be there in that conversation? Or is this time to like, kind of really take a step back, look at how I'm talking to myself, see if I want to replace that with something that's a little bit more helpful.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, cool. I like that. I like that metaphor a lot. I hadn't thought of it in that way. So that's really cool. So yeah. what are some of the ways that people get stuck in narrator mode? Like what are some of the common patterns you see with your clients of people, like how they talk to themselves, both like harmful ways or potentially some, you know, helpful ways?
Yeah. So I think it's important to answer. I want to start this kind of answer by reminding everyone of there are different styles of communicating, right? So again, like when I'm at a reunion with all my like rugby buddies from college, it's going to be a style dominated by lots of like joking and kind of jabs and like verbal roughhousing, right? You could say.
Yeah.
But when I'm talking with a client in therapy, it's going to be very different, right? The style I approach it with is going to be much, much, much different. And it's not that one or the other is bad or good, right? They're just better or worse, more helpful in different situations and with different people. So right. We can think about the same thing with ourselves, with our self-talk. And when people get into trouble with self-talk is when their self-talk gets really stuck. They get stuck in a certain style of talking to themselves or about things that happen. And they can't shift gears, to introduce a new metaphor here.
Yeah.
So like a really common one, for instance, is, technically they're called cognitive distortions, but their style, their ways of thinking about things that are either inaccurate or kind of unhelpful. And so one of them is called fortune telling, right? And fortune telling is when you are basically predicting the future. Now, the ability to predict the future it can be a really great thing. Our ability to kind of imagine like what's going to happen in the future, obviously super important. Like I'm glad we can do that, right?
Yeah.
But we do that well when there's some data or evidence for what's going to happen in the future. When you're reasoning based on real kind of data or evidence or yeah whatnot. But when you're doing that, when you're just catastrophizing, for instance, you're just going straight to the worst case scenario, right? Without any reason for going there, that's a mental habit you can get into. You can just get into the habit of immediately starting to tell yourself, oh, this terrible thing is going to happen, ... and then kind of going down that like rabbit hole.
This is never going to work. I'm going to fail college. No one's going to like me. You know, things like that, right?
Exactly. And that would be like, yeah, not only is it inaccurate, right, when you're kind of making assumptions about the future, but you don't actually have any evidence or data for that. But it's just not especially helpful, right? So that's one of them. Mind reading is another one where, again, there's a useful version of this where I'm kind of listening to you and I'm inferring from your facial expressions that like, all right, Nick, like this is getting pretty boring. Like, let's move on to the next thing. Like, that's good that I can kind of read you, right? And get a sense for maybe what you're thinking.
All of these things could have a function when they're used in the right time, right? Like, so mind reading, like trying to empathize or understand what someone else is thinking can help you be a little bit more in tune to them, but then it can go wrong, right?
Yeah, I mean, but if you do that constantly, like, and you do it without any sort of real evidence, if I'm just making up stories in my mind about what you're thinking of what I'm talking about, that can start to be really unhelpful. It can start to lead to a lot of unnecessary anxiety, stress, frustration, anger, whatever it is. So I think the first kind of takeaway, I think, when it comes to self-talk is just to realize there are different like styles of mm-hmm. thinking, right? Sometimes you're going to be really kind of jokey or even sarcastic, right? Sometimes you're going to be really empathetic and supportive. Sometimes you're going to be really intellectual. Sometimes you're going to be really pragmatic. None of these are good or bad, right? But they're different styles of thinking. And just like you can have different styles of thinking about the world and what's happening, you can have different styles of thinking about yourself and talking to yourself. Mm-hmm. And so first of all, it's just important to be aware of that and to ask yourself, do I tend to get really stuck in one particular style? Like, do I tend to personalize? That's another one, right? Whenever something bad happens and something, you know, someone critiques my work, I instantly go from, you know, they didn't like the presentation to they think I'm a terrible employee, right? Or instead of like, yeah, I put my foot in my mouth and said that kind of insensitive thing and they didn't like that, it's they think I'm a terrible person, or like, or I'm an awful husband or spouse or something like that. Right.
Yeah. And yeah. So you take like a little mistake, or you take a little flaw or some piece of criticism, and you turn this into your identity, right? You're like, oh, I am a terrible mother, instead of, oh, I just did that thing that wasn't great. Like, I'm a terrible mother. Right.
Right. And, yeah. And these things are all, we oftentimes we can kind of see them after the fact. If someone points out, you know, the next day, like, you kind of like jump into conclusions there, or like maybe you're kind of projecting out into the future and there's not a lot of good reason. You can, after the fact, you can step back and go like, oh yeah, okay, there wasn't a whole lot of evidence for that. Or I know I'm not a terrible person just because I made one mistake. The trick though is to be able to see it in the moment. And this is where it's really hard to be able to move out of that narrator voice and see yourself like you would the author, to be able to see both the narrator and the character and to take a more kind of balanced perspective on things. And it's just really hard, and it takes a lot of practice to be able to do that. But before you can even start to work on that, you have to start thinking about self-talk more generally and these different styles. That's why we have these little like names like fortune telling or mind reading or personalizing or emotional reasoning, or there's all these different labels, because the label, when you have a word for something, it's easier to think about it. Right? If you don't have language for something, you're just not going to think about it. Right?
Right.
But once you have a word for it, you're going to go, oh, wait, hey, I'm doing that thing, right? I'm mind reading. I'm like projecting into. And so having a word allows us to have more awareness. And when you have more awareness, you can catch it.
Okay. So giving it a name creates more awareness. And when you have awareness, then you can start catching it. And if not right in the moment, you can start catching it after, even like not even until your next therapy session, the next time you sit down and journal.
Yep.
Then gradually you can bring that closer and closer to that event when you're doing it. And then hopefully catch yourself right before you do it and say, oh, exactly. Is this what I want to do? Is this how I want to talk to myself, right?
Yeah. And if you think about it, that's how any process of skill acquisition works. It's always like slow and awkward at first. And you're only catching stuff after, you know, if you think about like practicing scales on the piano or swinging a golf club or baking something, I don't know, whatever it is, you always feel slow. Like you always feel like you're playing catch up. Yeah. But if you stick with it, it gets a little bit faster and you get more and more to the point where you can notice it in the moment. So I always try and remind people, even if you're getting frustrated because you're catching it later after the fact, that's okay. That's normal. In every area of life, this is how we learn, right? We're slow and it takes a while. So don't give up just because you don't catch it in the moment. That's not bad. That's not a bad sign. That's totally normal. You're like all of us, like trying to learn anything, right? And so that's good. Even if you can't catch it until your next therapy session or a couple hours afterwards, that's fine. The more you catch it a day later, the easier it's going to be to catch it an hour later. And the more you catch it an hour later, the more you're going to catch it, you know, 5 minutes later. And pretty soon, you'll start to be able to catch it more in the moment, which is really the sweet spot. Because if you can catch it in the moment, you can actually influence it and go a different direction. Right. Which is that's the holy grail. Like that's what we all want to get to. Right.
Yeah. So how do we do that? Right. So if we've got this habitual pattern, we've been doing it maybe our whole lives, maybe we were spoken to this way as kids, right? Like our parents maybe said, oh, you're a failure. You're an idiot, or you're going to fail, or stop that. You're so stupid, or, you know, labeling or this talk. And then we develop this habit of internal self-talk and that we're trying to change it. This is like bushwhacking neural pathways. That's like combining a couple of things, but right. Like we can change our brain, but it takes a while to beat these new pathways into our brain, right? So how do we do that? How do we start changing our self-talk? So first thing you mentioned is like get a name for it. find out a name, learn about these cognitive distortions, and then start being aware of them, start noticing them. And then if you can catch them soon enough, you can rewrite them, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. So you got to have a name, a label, right? Start to catch them, even if it's after the fact, that's okay. Don't get discouraged, right? That's helpful. That's still helpful. The kind of next like intermediary step there is starting to be aware, not just of these patterns of thinking, these distortions, but triggers, right? Certain things in your environment, certain people, certain ways of talking, certain things that happen to you are going to be especially triggering of certain patterns of self-talk. So if you can anticipate those triggers, you're going to be much more likely to catch them. Like if you just know that, you know, on like Thursday afternoons, like my boss is always super stressed because of some meeting she has, and she's just more likely to kind of say something biting or insensitive. If you know that going into your Thursday meeting with her, it's not going to surprise you. And so you're not going to be as flustered. If you see it coming, it's a lot easier to anticipate it and to deal with it well.
That makes so much, that's such a important thing to remember, because I forget about that a lot, like this triggers thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe as a woman, I can say this, but like, I think it's important to track your periods, because right before your period, that is when my negative self-talk is like, oh my gosh, Emma, you are a terrible human being. And if I can be like, oh, this is probably at that point in my cycle, I'm just going to ignore that until I feel better. I don't believe that. I don't cycle into that, you know, so much. I don't know if that's a terrible example, but that's
I think that's a great, I talk about it with my female clients all the time, actually. That comes up a lot. So it's super, super common. And that's just as meaningful a trigger as anything else. And being aware of those, you know, this term trigger, I should take a little minute to talk about this for a second. This has become more common in sort of like popular vernacular. People talking about like, I was triggered. I like to make the distinction that I don't love the idea that you can be triggered by something, right? Triggers happen, right? Yeah. Their effect on you depends on how you interpret the trigger and what it means, right? So if you want to be less triggered by things, the important thing is to notice what are the triggers, but more importantly then, what are the reactions in me those tend to set off? Because if you can catch those, then you can exert some control over them, right?
And so you're not just at the
mercy. Yeah.
This is why I love your blog, because it's all about like actionable steps, right? Like, so, I feel like so much pop psychology out there is like, oh my gosh, if you're triggered, not your fault, you should just, it's okay to not be okay. Just, you know, avoid those situations. And what you're talking about is like, oh, here's how to become an agent. Here's how to be an actor in your life and to choose, you know, what's in your control and what isn't. Like a triggering event is not necessarily in your control, but that's not you. That's an event. And there's something you can choose, and that's your locus of control. That's your area of control. And that's what we're going to work on.
Exactly. Yep. So if you've done kind of those, like, first of all, identify, know that like, hey, self-talk is a thing. I tend to talk to myself sometimes. It's not always super helpful. There are these specific modes of talking to myself. Right. And if I can give those a name, they're like, oh, there goes my mind reading, right? Or, oh, there goes my labeling, whatever it is. You can catch it more easily. If you're aware of the kinds of triggers, like situations in your environment or your life or certain people where those unhelpful styles of thinking are more common, you can anticipate them, right? Which makes you can adapt better. You can be a little bit faster instead of being kind of behind the curve all the time. Then I think the next step is to realize just because a thought is the first one that comes into my mind, that doesn't give it any like special value. Just because it's first doesn't mean it's more correct or that I should think more about it, or like, it's just the first one. It's just the first one who happened to show up. Mm-hmm. So that is super, super important, because if you can do that, if you can recognize like, okay, it's the first one and not give any special priority to it, it opens the door to the most, in some ways, what's the most important step, which is generating alternatives, alternative stories for what something means, right? So you like, I lose my temper and like raise my voice at my daughter, right? Something like that. If my first thought is like, God, you're a terrible dad, like she's gonna end up in therapy for the rest of her life because you're awful. if that's my first thought and I just assume, okay, that's true, well, now that's going to lead me down this very unhelpful path of thinking, which is like, oh, I'm a terrible dad. Like all this stuff is going to go bad, like blah, 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 blah. And then of course I'm going to feel awful.
Yep.
I'm not going to be able to help the situation, like my daughter, because right. I'm feeling so bad, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if I can catch that initial thought and say, okay, wait a second here. Like, really? Like you're a terrible dad because God forbid you lost your temper once and raised your voice a little bit. I don't think so. Like the action was not helpful, right? But yeah. That does not invalidate me as a person or as a parent, right? So mm-hmm. another sort of story or way of looking at that, well, one is exactly what I said. Like just because one specific action does not define me as a person, right? Yeah. Or I might say something like, you know, I regret doing that, but you know, all parents lose their cool sometimes. It doesn't, you know, like it happens to everybody. Right? That would be another sort of interpretation of things. Like it's not that abnormal, right? Yeah. Or even another one might be like, you know what? Like I don't like that I sort of yelled at my daughter, but actually it's important for her to see that if she does certain things, right, that are against the rules, or that are, if she's like mean to her sister, right, that has consequences. Like people, like it's okay for her to see me getting angry sometimes in response to what she does. That in itself is not. So these are all examples of different stories, or if you prefer, sort of different theories for what something means. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to kind of be a scientist about this. Like science would not go very well as a project if people only went with the very first theory they had for things, for why things happen.
Right, yeah.
Science progresses because we generate lots of different theories, right? And then we test them out and we see which ones are actually the most true and helpful. Yeah. And so I think it's all about learning that we can do the same thing with ourselves. Just because one theory pops into your mind, that doesn't mean anything about how true or helpful it is. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to be able to escape that one story or theory if you don't generate some alternatives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To come up with some different explanations.
Yeah. I love that because, not only are we questioning a little bit our thinking, and then we can put out five or six alternative ways of describing or making stories about what happened, but then we can ask ourselves which one's true and which one's helpful. And I think sometimes when someone's like really depressed or really anxious, asking that first question can be hard. Which one's true? Like someone who's really depressed, like, is it true that you're a terrible, horrible, hopeless human being? And they'll be like, well, I think so. But if you ask, is it helpful to believe that you're a terrible human being? Does that help you get out of bed in the morning? No, that does not help, right? So asking either of those questions can help people like challenge their thinking and take something like a little bit more action, right?
Yep. Good yeah, I like to tell people, if you're struggling with that, if you're like, well, I just can't think of anything that's more true or that's more helpful, doesn't matter. Literally anything is better than just having one story and going with it. Even if the other things you generate are completely bonkers and off the wall, right? That's at least a step in the right direction. You're getting a little bit more flexible with your thinking. And that's really important because how we feel emotionally flows directly from how we think, and in particular, how we talk to ourselves. So if you're stuck in one particular way of talking to yourself, that's really unhelpful and overly negative, for instance, you're going to be stuck feeling that way. And your only hope of getting out of that is if you can flex things, if you can get a little bit more flexible, right?
Yeah.
And so even if you can't come up with something that's like, oh yeah, that's a really good idea. Like, why didn't I think of that before? Like sometimes it just doesn't happen, right? Sometimes you can't think of any alternative is better than just staying with one. So I think that's important for people to know, especially early on as you work with this stuff. It's a little like that people will say like any workout session is a good workout session. Like you just going to the gym and doing something is way better than not going at all. Whether you like hit your, you know, workout goals or got a good time when you're running or whatever, like that's great, but that's way less important than just going in the first place. And it's the same with our self-talk. Like just being a little bit flexible is way better than not doing anything at all.
Yeah, so we increase that flexibility by challenging those stories, right? We challenge how we're talking to ourselves. We throw out.
Well, and even, sorry to cut you off, but it's not necessarily challenge. You can challenge it, right? Like you can look at it like, okay, wait, that thought, that's not very true. Like what's a more accurate way of looking at this? That's fine. It doesn't have to be challenging though in nature. It could just be more exploratory, I could be just like, well, okay, like that's one way of looking at it, but like, I don't know, are there other ways of looking at it, right? Like, what might someone else say in response to this, right? Like, how would my wife react to this? Like, how would my best friend react to this? How would my dad react to this? So sometimes, and this goes back to your point early on about, I think one of the sort of improvements we've made on traditional cognitive therapy and how we think about the relationship between self-talk and emotion is sometimes getting, especially if you tend to be really hard on yourself in the first place, if getting really challenging with your thoughts is your only way of getting at it, that you can end up sliding into more kind of unhelpful styles of thinking. So I like to remind people that you can challenge your thoughts, but you can also just explore alternatives. And sometimes that's at least as helpful as deliberately like challenging a particularly unhelpful thought.
That's good, because yeah, if people get wrapped into that struggle of fighting their thoughts, that can get them trapped. So just exploring, just be curious, right? See what else there is. Try and be a little bit flexible. That's a good way of thinking about that. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Any other ways like that you would encourage people? Like, is there another step after that? Or is there another way to encourage people to start thinking about themselves differently that you recommend or teach?
Yeah, so there's a couple other sort of approaches to, if you notice that you've got a lot of negative self-talk in your life, whatever that form is, maybe you personalize stuff a lot, maybe emotional reasoning, maybe you're like fortune telling or mind reading a lot, whatever the case may be, you can kind of get in there and sort of either challenge your thinking to be more realistic or helpful, or to just generate alternative hypotheses or theories for what's going on. That's one kind of approach. The other one that we don't have to spend a ton of time on, but I think is important to mention, you don't have to think anything. You don't have to tell a story at all, actually. I feel like this is a very important option that none of us think about. We just assume that like, okay, I got to start thinking about more, like something stressful happened, like better spend the next 2 hours thinking about it.
Like no, analyze your life. Yeah.
You literally don't have to, right?
Okay.
If you're feeling bad, it's usually good to acknowledge that and say like, okay, you know what? I just kind of blew up at my daughter. Probably wasn't the most helpful thing to do, but you know what? Like, I'm trying to get dinner ready. I will revisit this later and kind of like explore it, and I'll talk to her about it later. But right now, like, I don't have to sit here and like brood about it. So I think you can kind of take a rain check on this stuff. I think that's an important option that a lot of people don't always remember or realize. You don't have to think anything at all.
Stop thinking all the time? Like, I'm not very good at like not thinking about things all the time.
That's a good point. You can't actually not think exactly, right? That's the famous like white elephant or white bear experiments where they tell people like, well, don't think about a white bear. Well, then you end up just thinking more about a white bear, right? When I say you don't have to think about it, you don't have to think about that. You don't have to come up with a story for that particular event or how you're feeling.
Like your whole life about analyzing and figuring out and swirling around in that, you know.
You can switch and go decide like, how am I going to slice the bell peppers? Like that's a perfectly valid like redirection of your thinking. You can think about something else instead.
Just switch to something more important or something more valuable to you, right? Like something that you want to be thinking or working on. That's helpful, right? You don't have to spend all this time analyzing. Okay, that makes sense. That's a great idea,
And just, if you think about it, and this sort of leads into my third point, I think most of us realize that different people in our life, like if you think about important people in your life, you know, maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a kid, parent, best friend, whatever. When people are upset, like when someone comes to you and they're upset and they want your support or advice, or people are different in what they need, right? Mm-hmm. So some people, like when I'm upset, I want to talk about it right away. Like that's how I process that. I'm very verbal, like obviously. I love talking stuff out like right away. Like that's what I want to do, right?
Yeah.
My wife, on the other hand, she likes to like give things, she likes to let things breathe a little bit and just like sit on things for a little while and then revisit it a little bit more analytically or verbally, right? That's important. Like neither of those are necessarily better than the other, right? But it's important to kind of remember that like that applies to yourself too. Like you don't have to get into this bit, you don't have to do like therapy with yourself like as soon as you start feeling bad. You can just like say, okay, this is important. I'm a little upset. I'm going to put this on the back burner and revisit it tonight when I do my journaling or tomorrow in therapy or like whatever it is, right? Yeah. Or even just like in a half an hour when I'm not in the middle of like getting dinner on the table. right? There, just because you're delaying it doesn't mean you're going to forget about it or not deal with it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really, really key. But the other, this kind of thinking about other people is a good segue to the other kind of, I would say maybe third approach to negative self-talk, which is you don't have to challenge it or even develop sort of alternative theories. And you don't necessarily just have to redirect and think about something else. The other thing you can do is what we sort of therapists and mental health professionals call self-compassion, which I have mixed feelings about because I love the idea of self-compassion. It's super important. I feel like the phrase turns a lot of people off. So yeah. I'm going to try and explain it in a very straightforward way, which is when we're struggling, we feel bad for something, say we're worried about something. Most of us, I think, our self-talk tends to be pretty intense is the word. It tends to be a little harsh, often judgmental. If you were to kind of describe like the quality of your inner narrator, I think words like that would come up a lot. Like we're very tough on ourselves in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah. I think most people are a lot harder on themselves than on anyone else in their lives.
Well, and that's the big irony, right? Like we're so hard on ourselves. And yet like in the next breath, we can be amazingly like compassionate and empathetic and supportive when like our best friend who's struggling with the exact same thing comes to us. Like we're like this model of empathy and support for this other person in our life. And we're just like awful to ourselves, right? We're super harsh and critical and judgmental. Yeah. So this idea of self-compassion, that sounds fancy. All it means is learning to treat yourself like you would treat a friend who is struggling. So when you're struggling, right, just applying the same, not having a double standard, applying the same standard of support and empathy that you would apply to someone else who you cared about, and learning to apply that to yourself, and that's totally okay. And actually, turns out, secret, it works a lot better than being super hard on yourself.
Right, like that's the thing, like I think, when I try and present this idea to my clients, they resist it initially, like, well, that's just a cop-out, right? Like, that's just excusing behavior. Like, if I'm nice to myself, well, what's that going to stop me from yelling at my kid next time, right? What do you say to that?
I like to think about this. If the person I'm talking to has kids, the metaphor I use is there's a really big difference between being, like, indulgent and spoiling your kids and being kind to them. Just because you're kind to your kids doesn't mean you're spoiling them or being indulgent, right? There's a world of difference between those two things. And so I think it's a matter of degree. Like just because you're kind to yourself and you like give a reason for like, hey, you know, like, yes, I wish I hadn't yelled at my daughter. That was not okay. I do not want to do that again. But you know, like it's understandable. Like she just like whacked her sister with a baseball bat. Like it's not totally surprising, right?
Yes.
So like, I don't think that means like I'm like escaping responsibility with myself or something like that necessarily. But at the end of the day, what I tell people is don't take my word for it. Just experiment with it a little bit.
Yeah.
For a week, try treating yourself when you struggle like you would treat a friend. If it doesn't work or it leads you to becoming a completely irresponsible, terrible person, fine, give it up. You don't have to stick with it, right? But just try it out for like a week and see what happens.
Yeah. Right?
And so that often I can get a little more buy-in with people because they're not committing to like a new lifetime of just taking it easy on themselves. But the other part of this that I think is confusing is our standard is just way out of whack. What feels normal for us being super hard on yourself is in the scheme of things, it's actually really abnormal, but because it's the way we've always been, it feels normal, which means anything sort of on the kinder, gentler side is going to feel really extreme, even though you're actually moving closer to normal, right? Yeah. But you're biased because you've been stuck in this really harsh mode of talking to yourself, and that's your normal. Right. It's like anything else. Like if you decide you want to start like exercising and like running on the treadmill.
Yeah.
If you haven't run at all in the last 3 years and you get on a treadmill, you're going to feel awful.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, totally. Right?
You're going to be really sore. But that doesn't mean it's the wrong thing. It just means you're not used to it.
Yeah.
And so I think applying kind of a similar mindset to our own self-talk, I just encourage people to experiment with treating yourself the way you would treat a good friend. And that ends up being a really powerful, in the long run, a really powerful antidote to this problem of overly harsh, negative, judgmental self-talk.
Mm-hmm. And that takes us like right back to the beginning, right? You're talking about this is like almost like a relationship, right? You talk to your buddies in one way, you talk to your grandma in another way. How we talk to ourselves changes how we feel. And it really impacts our emotions. And if we can be a little bit flexible and be a little bit curious and maybe experiment with some different ways of talking to ourselves, try it for a week, right? Try being gentle to yourself like you would be with a friend and see if that, you know, impacts how you feel, impacts how you act, makes your life a little bit better.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's really about relationships. You know, like we all know, if you want to have a good relationship with your spouse or your best friend or your coworkers, right? It helps if you treat them in a certain way, if you treat them with respect and kindness, and it doesn't mean you don't hold them to any kind of standards or you just let them do whatever they want. But yeah, you do what you would do with any important relationship in your life. Like, why not foster that same kind of relationship with yourself? I think is the way to look at this. And I think ends up being the most helpful in the long run.
I would agree with you. Well, that's awesome. Is there anything else you want to share as we wrap this up?
I mean, I feel like I've kind of word vomited all over you. Like, this is just a lot. So I don't want to overwhelm people, but it's something you mentioned. I think maybe a good place to end is this idea that if you tend to be really harsh and judgmental with yourself, another option is you can be curious with yourself. Like when you notice yourself feeling angry, right? Or overly personalizing something, you can step back and instead of saying like, oh yeah, it must be terrible. Or I can't believe I'm thinking like that. Like what an awful way of thinking. There's this middle ground of just like, oh, like that's interesting that would be my first response. Huh? And if you can approach things with that attitude of curiosity, almost always it will open up many more doors and more helpful sort of ways to proceed. In my experience, it sounds like you.
Yeah. Like it just creates space, right? Like just being curious about what you're doing creates space. And when we have that space, like change suddenly has options, right? We have the option to change. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love it. Well, cool. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day, your busy schedule to talk with us. I think my audience is going to love geeking out on all this self-talk stuff. So
that is awesome. Great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
This podcast was adapted from a YouTube video from my YouTube channel, Therapy in a Nutshell. So if you'd like to see more of my videos, check that out and go subscribe on YouTube. Also, you can sign up for my newsletter at www.therapynutshell.com. Thanks for watching. Thank you for listening, and take care.